This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, a conversation with the state's new poet laureate.
I feel like I best serve the community in this role because I really believe that artists and poets are always at the forefront of culture change.
Plus, how are ski passes changing the industry?
Season pass business right now is a battle over skier loyalty. Pick a side.
And we'll look at broadband access around the state.
That's coming up.
It's Monday, September 2nd. You're listening to Colorado Edition on KUNC. I'm Aaron O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. Labor Day marks the unofficial end of summer. And although it's not quite winter, we are inching closer to the start of ski season.
And the ski industry has changed a lot in the past few decades. Now, instead of just getting a season pass to your favorite local resort, there's a whole world of passes that can allow you to ski around the world. But what has that meant for the ski industry? Joining us is Jason Blevins from the Colorado Sun. Jason, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks, Sarah.
For people who don't know, how generally do ski passes work?
Well, they typically go on sale like in the spring, and about a nine-month sale cycle for season passes. This is sort of the final lap for season pass sales starting at Labor Day. The prices will start going up. The resorts are really urging skiers to commit. That is the whole idea of this new season pass dynamic. Buy those passes early.
Buy them early, and you're basically committing to which resort you're going to go to, right?
Exactly. Season pass business right now is a battle over skier loyalty. Pick a side.
What considerations should a person take into account when they're looking for a ski pass? I mean, probably a big one is how often they ski, but what else should be factored in?
Well, first would be frequency and how much you're willing to spend. The Epic Pass by Vail Resorts is about $939, and the Icon Pass by Alterra Mountain Co. is a little over $1,000. Those prices might seem pretty steep at first blush, but if you remember that this is a season-long worth of skiing, as well as the fact that these prices are almost half of what they were about 20 years ago. So these are significant discounts for season passes compared to what we used to pay in the 90s.
Why have they gotten cheaper? I mean, is it the competition?
A little bit. Vail Resorts about 11 years ago now, released sort of a transformational product was that if the company could get skiers to commit early to their lift tickets and their season passes, the threat of bad snow and rough snow years would be somewhat diminished by the company. So buy a pass early, you are able to sort of offset the company's risk. The skier assumes some of the resort operator's risk by buying these passes, you know, several months before the lifts start turning.
Many people say passes like these are changing the skiing world. How is this playing out? I mean, if you listen to the ads, it's like a win for consumers, but is it really?
I'm a skier and I have two daughters and a wife, and we go skiing and we all need a season pass, and I'm paying significantly less than what I would have paid 20 years ago to ski. So in many ways, the price of skiing right now is lower than it was in the 90s, even the 80s. Another aspect here is that this season pass war has fueled a competitive environment that has these resorts really investing in the ski experience. That means we're seeing new lifts, new restaurants, better grooming. On the flip side of that is our automobiles. We love to drive to the ski resorts.
Oh, yes.
And finding a place to put those cars and getting those cars into those mountain valleys is a real challenge. And I mean, there's no question, we have had a tremendous impact on the roads and the traffic scene. All these pass holders heading up there, it's really changed the dynamic of weekend travel in the mountains. You're certainly not going out for a pleasurable Sunday drive. It's more of an arduous process. But again, we are seeing more investment in the mountains, and skiing is more affordable than it has been in a long time. So Right. It's six of one, half dozen the other.
Why did you decide to write about this?
I have been covering skiing now for more than 20 years in Colorado. And one of the most common questions I get is, what pass should I buy? When are passes due? It's pretty crazy, all the options out there. You can really, if you don't mind, you know, moving around, not skiing on holidays, trying out of the way places, it's entirely possible to find some super affordable skiing experiences out there.
Jason Blevins is a reporter for the Colorado Sun. Jason, thanks for joining us and breaking this all down.
Thank you.
And you can find a link to Jason's reporting on ski passes at kunc.org.
Now, let's take a look at today's headlines.
Researchers in our region are looking for the answer to a question. How do you reduce doctor burnout if you can't just hire more doctors? By some estimates, it would take more than 20 hours a day for a primary care doctor to adequately care for their patients. So it's no wonder that doctors burn out a lot.
Inspired by research in Utah, Colorado clinics are trying something new, passing some of the task burden to medical assistants. Researchers followed two clinics that hired a bunch of medical assistants to help out. They found out that even though it costs a lot more to hire them, they were able to create a more efficient system, seeing more patients and providing more care. And a few years in, they found that clinician burnout rates plummeted from about 50% to 15%.
Foster children in Colorado now have a smoother road to reach an important milestone. A new law streamlines the process for those teens to get a driver's license. It allows them to get driving lessons and have their driving log signed by anyone who is older than 21 with a valid driver's license. Previously, it had to be a foster parent or legal guardian. The new regulations will impact more than 500 foster children currently of driving age.
A new species of tumbleweed is more vigorous and invasive than ones we've seen in the past. The tumbleweed named Salsola ryanai is a hybrid of two other tumbleweed species. It was discovered in California in the early 2000s, but new research from UC Riverside finds it has spread and could reach the Mountain West.
When it comes to connecting to the internet, most of us don't think twice about it, whether it's for work or for recreation. But in some parts of the state, that access is not a guarantee. That's why the state set a goal of getting to 92% rural broadband coverage by June of 2020. Lawmakers even chipped in $100 million for the effort. And that's where our Capitol reporter Scott Franz comes into the picture. He's got a series of stories running this week on the issue of rural broadband, and he joins us now. Hey, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So why do a series on this topic?
Well, rural broadband's a topic I've always been interested in. Having lived in Steamboat Springs, Colorado before coming to the Capitol, you know, I often would drive just 20 minutes outside of, you know, the ski town of Steamboat and meet people who were still living with satellite internet connections. And
oh, wow.
For them, they spent years trying to get connected. It's also an issue that affects so many people in our state, especially in the Western Slope, the Eastern Plains. A lot of people see it as a very vital part of their lives, whether it's for economic development or entertainment. There's so many uses for it. Really wanted to do a series on it because we're at this time right now where the state is investing so much money, spending so much time trying to get rural Colorado connected. And I really just wanted to see how the process was going. It's something we've heard about for years, but I really wanted to go to some of the most off-the-grid places to see, you know, are people getting connected? And if they are, how is it changing their lives?
Can you tell us about the places that you visited and how you decided to go there?
I really keyed in on where to go when I found a map online that showed, you know, of all the millions of dollars the state has already spent trying to connect people, it showed that the real epicenter and the most activity was happening in southwest Colorado, really around Montrose, Telluride, Ridgeway, some of these remote places that take 6-7 hours to get to from Denver.
Wow. And so how are the state's efforts going in these places?
You know, I don't want to spoil anything in the series, but I will tell you from the outset here, I have to give it mixed reviews. Mm. Some people I talk to think the state is aiming too low in its goal. For example, you know, Colorado defines broadband and high-speed internet as having a download speed of 25 megabits per second and an upload speed of 3 megabits per second. Now, if you're not familiar with the speeds, you know, those are adequate to stream movies and, you know, browse web pages. That's a standard we set about 4 years ago. Mm. And Mark Kurtz, who is one of the heads of the broadband companies I talked to, who's trying to bring it to places, here he is talking about why he's concerned about that standard.
My problem with even 25.3, I think by the time we get 100% of Colorado to 25.3, that will already be an antiquated service that, again, will not let people do what they need to do, and we'll all be back later asking for funding again to try and get that 25.3 to a greater level. So we would like to see that level at Elevate really be 100 megabits minimum right now.
Now, there are also some people out there who aren't even on the state's radar. One of the last stops I made was in a fly fishing apparel store in the tiny town of Placerville. It's just outside of Telluride, and the brothers who run the business are still using microwave internet, something that can be impacted by storms. It's weather dependent, and they don't have any other option. You know, here's Grant Dorn telling me about how it impacts their business.
Sometimes if the internet goes down for long periods of time, we can't print orders, we can't ship orders, we can't really do anything here. So a lot of times we're kind of just dead in the water on those days when the internet goes down, which is tough for a small business.
And the challenge for Grant Dorn right now is he doesn't have someone willing to help get fiber and broadband to the small community he lives in. You know, if you go just 14 miles to the east, the people are spending millions of dollars to get better connections in the resort town of Telluride. And even to the west, the small town of Norwood is also getting connected. But, you know, they're facing their own headaches. But these projects are going to go right by where Dorn and the fly fishing shop are because he's just in such a small town.
Well, it's going to be a fascinating series. Where are we going to start off with the first one?
We're going to start out in the little town of Norwood, Colorado, just under 600 people, near Telluride. And we're going to look at kind of what I was just talking about, some of the challenges of bringing broadband to a small community that is geographically challenged by, you know, getting the fiber there. And yeah, I'm excited to take you there.
We're excited to hear it. And you can hear that on Colorado Edition tomorrow. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
In July, Governor Jared Polis appointed a new poet laureate for the state of Colorado, the eighth since the program started 100 years ago.
His name is Bobby Lefebvre, and he's an Emmy-nominated performer who believes that poetry has the power to heal and promote cultural change. I met Lefebvre a few weeks ago at Su Teatro Cultural and Performing Arts Center in Denver. It's where a play he wrote, Northside, is currently being performed. He began by telling us how he first got into the arts.
The first experience that I had where I knew art was going to be part of my life was in eighth grade. My social studies teacher at the time, Mrs. Allen, she ran National History Day, which is a national competition where students take some sort of event from history and make some sort of artistic production, either a play, a poster board, a film, and compete at a local and then national level if you make it. So she put me in this production of a play about Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in sports. And it was the first time that I had ever done any acting. I had been in choir, so I was, you know, I enjoyed that. But Mrs. Allen put me on stage for the first time. I played a racist baseball player that didn't want Jackie Robinson on the team. We ended up taking this play to the state competition, and then we ended up at the national competition. It was actually the first time that I was on a plane as a kid, and went to D.C., and I think we placed like fifth in the nation. But that was the first time that I had ever engaged in art as an artist, and that was as an actor. And I knew at that point that that was going to be a part of me. So I actually began my artistic career as an actor in theater. That later morphed into on-camera work, getting an agent, and, you know, then I came to poetry in my late teens, started keeping notebooks, writing poetry, raps, and began going to open mics here in Denver, which led to me writing more and honing my skills a little bit more, which led to me reading and writing more poetry, ultimately studying more, participating in Poetry Slam, which took me all over the country. Did that for a couple of years. And after that, I actually toured the college and university circuit performing poetry. I had an agent that booked me at colleges and universities all over the country. Continue to, you know, hone skill and read and write. Studied with the previous poet laureate in my master's program at the University of Denver, and a bunch of stuff in between, and here we are.
I'm curious, in those kind of teenage years when you were getting into writing more and kind of spreading your poetry wings a little bit, who were you reading? Who kind of inspired you in that part of your...
You know, I didn't start by reading. At that point, I was heavily involved in hip hop culture. And so I actually came to poetic language through, you know, groups like A Tribe Called Quest and Mos Def and De La Soul and The Roots. These highly lyrical MCs were not only, you know, telling these really intricate first person narratives, but they were employing poetic device. You know, there's metaphor and simile and all of these things in that. So I came to appreciate language, I believe, through hip hop culture. In college is the first time that I really started reading intentionally more poetry, you know, and that started because for the first time I was taking classes in Chicano studies and African American studies, and I was reading literature that resonated with the experience that I had. So we were reading Sandra Cisneros, and we were reading, you know, all of the greats at the beginning, like Neruda. We were reading Toni Morrison. We were reading these, you know, these authors that were writing about people of color. And that allowed me to expand my horizons in literature. And then I began studying more about poetry. But I also credit, you know, street culture and, you know, like I said, hip hop and the oral tradition of poetry influenced me more so than the literary stuff.
Can you kind of explain that relationship to someone who maybe has a more formal approach to poetry, someone who kind of, you know, what they know about poetry is reading poems?
Sure. I think that, you know, there's this debate between the page and the stage, right? The oral versus the written. And I would say that, like anything, arts and culture and literature and poetry, it doesn't live outside of the house of racism and sexism and patriarchy and all these things that have shaped our institutions and society, right? So when we think about what the canon is of American literature, of poetry, it's mostly men, white men, and there's a whole bunch of voices and styles and aesthetics that are left out. And so poetry has always existed as an oral art form, right? If we look back throughout history, it was a way that we pass down culture and storytelling and really a marker of our collective identity. And only recently have we sort of imprisoned it to the page and books. So I would say that there's value in both. You know, I think the worst thing is to have an amazing writer who's a terrible presenter, you know, and all too often writers are so consumed with what they're going to write on the page that they don't even, you go to a reading and people are falling asleep. And so there's a perfect marriage, I think, between studying writing and craft while at the same time being able to effectively present that. And that's was part of the call for the poet laureate position, was you had to effectively read, write, and perform poetry. And so there's a whole literary tradition in orality. There's, you know, poets that, you know, come from the oral tradition. And a lot of these are, you know, communities of color that have used call and response. You know, back in Mesoamerican times, the Mexica people, you know, more popularly known as the Aztecs, they had someone called the Tlatoani. And the Tlatoani was the person who spoke, right? And they used their gift of language to organize people, to tell stories, to convey messages. And really, poetry is about communication. It's about connecting with people. And all too often, I feel like writers get so consumed with trying to be so intelligent and smart that nobody understands them. That's counterproductive to what the art form, I think, is really about.
I'm going to go back to something you said about the world of arts not being disassociated with the world of racism and the effects of racism. You being named poet laureate, you being the first person of color to be named that, I'm curious how you feel about that designation and your role within it.
I mean, I'm obviously not the first person of color to be qualified for this position, right? I think that there are a ton of folks who could have occupied this space before me. So I think it's important to note that. I'm grateful for the opportunity, but I'm also really excited that our state, that the, you know, board that reviewed the applications, and ultimately that the governor was willing to try something new and to go a different route and to show the span of what poetry can mean, what it looks like, what it can sound like. But I'm very grateful that I'm the youngest and the first person of color. And in that, I feel a certain responsibility to help amplify and elevate voices that we haven't traditionally heard from. And that's part of what I intend to do with this post. I think that we are at a point in our society where there are large-scale shifts that are happening. In this city, for instance, in Denver, we just had, you know, really strong women of color elected to city council. And I feel like arts and culture, myself as a poet, as a culture worker, I feel like I best serve the community in this role because I really believe that artists and poets are always at the forefront of culture change, right? Before we see policy change, before we see large-scale institutional change, it's the hearts and minds of people that change first, and artists do that. Artists have the ability to distill and translate messages to organize people's thoughts and feelings, which then puts their actions into order. And so I'm excited to be able to do this from this perspective because I do value diversity and inclusion, and I talk about race and social justice and just about everything I do. And that's the lens in which the next 4 years this position is going to operate from. I think the position is interesting because I forgot there was a poet laureate, and I don't remember what state it was, or it may have been a national poet laureate, but I read somewhere that when they asked them, you know, what does a poet laureate do? They're like, I don't actually know. And this is, you know, newly appointed poet laureate. And I think that it does sound like this very like esoteric thing, right? But for me, I'm most excited about traveling all over the state, connecting with people in all the corners and shadows, and not only sharing work, but learning from people. Like I don't want to go into communities with this prepackaged show where I read poems and I maybe do the same workshop and I do the same thing everywhere. I want to connect with people ahead of time and say, hey, what are you all going through in your community? How can my presence help? And how do I not take, how do I give more than I take? And so I'm just interested to kind of figure out, it's early still. I don't really have a complete plan, but I do know that it entails being as busy as I possibly can within the capacity that the program and, you know, is able to administer. And I think that, you know, technically I'm serving as an ambassador to poetry, which sounds super, you know, wishy-washy. Like, what does that actually mean? But for me, I think it means using art and culture and poetry and literacy and literature as a way to connect with people, to find, again, you know, to break down all these barriers that we are imposing upon one another, and to help tell this state's inclusive collective story.
Bobby, thanks for your time.
Thank you for being here.
That was Bobby Lefebvre, Colorado's poet laureate, telling us about his early days in the arts and his plans for the position.
We're going to leave you today with some sounds of the Colorado State Fair, which wrapped up today in Pueblo. KUNC's Esther Honig attended, spoke with a number of colorful figures, including Charlie Boger.
Charlie Boger, and I am the swine master.
Swine master. How long have you been raising pigs?
17 years, lady. When we come to a fair, we want to see people in the crowd and just please the whole family. The parents can come and sit down. The kids have fun. It's an audience participation show. I split the crowd up into fours, give them a special cheerleader of each group. And if that pig wins, I bring them up and give them a special prize. We do a little silly dance. And it's all just about entertaining the people. And, you know, mother and daddy come by here and bring the kids by there and get them a Coke or a soda pop or something over there and a hamburger and have a few minutes to just sit and rest.
What's the secret to pig racing? How do you get them to go?
Well, it's just training. You've got to train them naturally. But, you know, it's a food motivated. Just any animal, you know, it's basically food. Anybody can make a pig run a circle. But it's flash and presentation. And as you can see, we've got the flash.
Okay, that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we'll discuss the lack of air conditioning in Denver schools. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. And just a reminder, you can hear Colorado Edition now on KUNC at 6:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday. And of course, you can still listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.